Good evening, folks. My name is Mike Blair, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Stanton, Virginia group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that I was an alcoholic, and for that I'll ever be ever grateful, I hope. I know I still am today, and I've been that way every day, a day at a time, the way I still do practically all of it. And it's working that way. I'm staying sober and glad of it and enjoying it, so why not keep it up? I do like to have the 12 steps. I'll read those and we'll get going. Here are the steps we took, which I suggested as a program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Number 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. I'm kind of a fundamentalist as far as the 12 steps are concerned, because I believe in them thoroughly. And I think it's our program, and that's it. It is our program. Now, the man I'm going to introduce, he just stood up as the oldest male AA outside of Bill Wilson in the world. I mean, he's not the oldest man maybe that way, but he's oldest in years of AA sobriety. Someone told me he was introduced in Florida one time as the second oldest man in the world. So I don't want to get that impression over here. He's not. He was around the 40th member to come in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's one of the first hundred, of course, when the big book was written. And he wrote a chapter in that called The Brewmaster. I read it today again. I read it a number of times. He started out in the old Oxford group in Akron in 1938. That's before the group was called AA. AA didn't get its name until after the book Alcoholics Anonymous was printed, the way I understand it. It was printed in 1939. And he started then the first AA group known as AA in Cleveland in 1939. But he had belonged to the old Oxford group, which was a branch of the Oxford movement of that time, which is now Alcoholics Anonymous. After the book was published, they must call the groups after the book, kind of the other way around, but that's the way I understand it is. I've talked to Clarence about it this evening. You know, if I'm wrong, well, you folks can read the big book and straighten me out sometime. Not much more I have to say, except to say with Clarence's experience and so forth, I'd be foolish to try to elaborate any on it, and he's here to do the talking anyway, so I'm going to let him do it. Clarence?
Thank you, Mac, and hello, everyone. My name is Clarence Snyder, and I live in St. Petersburg, Florida. And the first thing I want to do is thank the committee for asking Selma and I to come here and enjoy this weekend with you. This is not my first trip to Blackstone. I've been here before on several occasions. And I always look forward to a trip here. It's a long ways down here. We have our own little retreat started in Florida now. Since that started, 3 other ones have branched up already, and we just only got started in ours. So we're going to have a lot of it down there, I think. I think these retreats are great. I think they're going to be the salvation of our fellowship. There have been so many changes made in our fellowship over the years that I think there's a real necessity for us getting back to fundamentals once in a while. And I think these retreats furnish that opportunity for us. I'm certainly thankful for them. Why, you know, I'm not much for telling stories, but I do have a favorite Rumi story. I have several that I like very well. But one in particular comes to my mind whenever I come before a group of people who look as nice as you do, or almost as nice. You're all shined up here, and you look like $1 million, and everybody's happy and all. And it always reminds me of the story of Jerry the town drunk. The contrast, you know. Jerry had been drunk as long as anyone could remember. No one ever remembered ever seeing this guy sober. And he was always dirty. He used to be whiskered. He was about barefoot, and the hind end was out of his breeches, and he was dirty, and he stunk. Time went on, and eventually, what happens to every man happened to Jerry. He finally turned up his toes and died. Well, this presented a problem to the community, because really, Jerry was a community problem. And they had the problem of what to do with the remains. They had to bury him. So they got together, and the local barber agreed to shave him and cut his hair and clean him up and give him a bath. The local undertaker agreed to lay him out. Local haberdasher offered a shirt and a necktie. Local clothing man offered a suit. So everyone got together, and they had a funeral for Jerry. The next problem was to get a preacher to preach the funeral service. And this was kind of a tough job to do, but they finally got one who agreed to do this. And so everyone in town gathered, such as we are here tonight, at this funeral. It was a community affair. This preacher got up and he says, "Well, folks," he says, "we're here to pay our last respects to Jerry. We all knew him for what he was." He says, "You know, but I'm rather at a loss for words, because I just don't know what to say about a man like Jerry at a time like this." He says, "Frankly, I am stumped." But he says, "I'd like you all to do one thing. I'd like you all to come up here and take a look at Jerry and see how good he looks since he quit drinking." Well, we're here to talk about AA and Rummies and myself. The old story of where do we come from, how do we get here, and what happened to us, and what we're doing now. A long story how I got here. I shouldn't be here. By all rules of logic and common sense, I have no business here, because I came to a fellowship which did not exist yet. And when I arrived, as you heard Max say, I was about the 40th one who was exposed to this plan. There have probably been hundreds of thousands of people exposed since then. And there was no earthly reason or excuse for my being here. It's really one of those miracles we talk about. I was on the bum. Really, I was on the bum. People wonder about the days when I was drinking. I was a depression drinker. And I was not a high bottom drinker. I probably had a little bit of that early in my career, but my drinking career, I traveled down that path real fast like. And I can only say this, that the last couple of years or so of my drinking career, I was paying 7 cents a pint for my booze, and I was buying it in a wallpaper store. So that does not suggest high bottom drinking. I think everyone would come to this if the economic pinch got on and we had to have it. Why, we would go to the same thing. I wound up there, as did a lot of other fellas in those days. I married into a very clannish family many years ago, and this family was something else. They always stuck together. And I always had 2, 3, 4, or 5 of them in my house. And this is before things got too bad, even. And this family of mine, eventually, they used to have a habit of having family conferences in my home. I was never invited to these conferences. I was generally the subject under consideration. They would alternately give me another chance or throw me out. And I was in and out of that place like a yo-yo. This was my own home, incidentally. Finally, my last chance came, the very last chance. And this was predicated upon the idea that I should go to work for my brother-in-law. He was one of the committee. He used to do the throwing, and the throwing was to be done. He had a big tractor-trailer outfit, and he delivered merchandise from Cleveland to New York and back again. He had this big tractor outfit. So my job, I was supposed to go to work for him and be his assistant. I was to learn to drive this truck and be his helper. That was many, many years ago. And I might say at this point, those many years ago, I was always against work. Work was always a dirty word. And though these 30-odd years of sobriety of mine hasn't changed that opinion of work yet in my book. But after all these years, I have yet to get my hands on the wheel of that truck. I never made it. I had to go with him, and I went off on this trip, and I got away from him in Albany, and you know what happened. But he carried me on into New York, and he threw me out on the waterfront at New York. And he told me I was all done, and he wrote his sister, who was my wife at the time, and told her what had happened and what he'd done with this no-good so-and-so. So there I was. Winter's about to set in, and I don't have a nickel. I don't have any clothes. I don't have any place to go. I don't know anyone but one person in New York City. He had another sister, lived out in Yonkers, Virginia. Virginia had come over and stayed with us a good many times and for long periods of time. And I figured that Virginia would help me. She owed me something, at least. So I made it out to Yonkers. I knew where she lived because we had been there on our honeymoon. As I say, this was a clannish family. Someone was talking this morning about going and picking their mother-in-law on a honeymoon. I did that on my second marriage. I took my mother-in-law along. But this worked out well. Anyway, I started for Yonkers, and I got out there, and instead of going up to Virginia's house up on the top of a hill there, I went downhill, which happened to be an Italian neighborhood. I met some very interesting newfound friends there. And you know what happened. I got into that Dago Red with these newfound friends, and when I got up to Virginia's house, I was a sight to behold, I imagine. The only thing I remember about that trip to Virginia's house is that I was rolling around on the floor with her two kids. And me being dirty and drunk and stinking and all this sort of thing, Virginia took a dim view of this whole deal, and she put me in the back of her car and took me down to the waterfront where her brother had thrown me out, and she did likewise. I tell this story for a reason. I was alone. I didn't have a friend in the world. This was one of the big, high spots of my life, was this day, standing on that waterfront. Broke, friendless. It came to me that I was alone in a city of 7 or 8 million people. I was 600 miles from home. And there was not one person in this whole world who cared one tinker's damn whether I was alive or dead. This is an awful feeling to have. I shall never forget it. This feeling of aloneness. I had to exist, and I did. I existed for some time in New York. I tell this story because sometime later, something happened at Virginia's home. She had the doctor in for one of her kids. And this doctor got to talking about drinking. And she recited the story of my visit to her home, this drunken brother-in-law of hers, who once was such a nice guy and now is such a dirty, stinking, drunken bum. This doctor says, you know, that's an odd thing. I had a brother in law like that myself one time, who was a drunk. And he met some cult or other, some strange bunch of people, and they spend their time sobering up drunks. And since he met this cult, he hasn't had a drink anymore. And there's another doctor down in Akron, Ohio, who belongs to this strange cult, and he spends all his time sobering up drunks, fixing drunks. Says, if your brother-in-law ever gets to Cleveland, maybe he can go down to Akron and meet this doctor, and maybe that doctor can fix him. This was going on while I'm existing in New York City. Of course, I didn't know anything about this. Eventually, I got back to Cleveland. Why, I don't know. I certainly wasn't welcome, but we all eventually head for home. And I got up on the front porch, and it was in the middle of winter again. And the snow was up to my elbows. I can remember this. And I charged up on the front porch there. And I noticed one thing. It's funny, these little things we remember. So many things we don't remember, as we heard this morning. I remember the screens are up, the screen doors are up, and this is the middle of winter with snow 4 feet deep outside. So I didn't get in the house, and I pointed out to the little woman that she needed a man around the house since the screens are up in the middle of the winter time. She allowed us how she did need a man around the house, but not that badly. So that didn't work. But the meantime, her sister, Virginia, had contacted her about this doctor in Akron, Ohio. Told her about this doctor by letter, I guess. So Dorothy asked me if I'd like to get out and meet this doctor. She told me about this doctor that has some miraculous way of fixing drunks. So there wasn't anything I could do but go. I said, oh, sure, I'd be glad to meet him. I'd like to. So she put me in the back of her car and took me down to the bus station, and she bought me a one-way ticket to Akron. And she put me on the bus with Doc's name and address and in my little grimy paw. And away I went. And that's how I met my sponsor. I shall never forget this. As I got down there the first time to meet him, I went up in the Second National Bank building. I was expecting anything to happen. I got up there and he wasn't in his office. And it was a cold, blizzardy day. So I stayed in there. I was afraid to leave. Afraid I wouldn't get back in. And I kept walking up and down, pacing up and down in that hallway, and I'd pass the office, his office door there. And every time I passed his door, I'd look at this name on his door. It said, Robert Holbrook Smith, rectal surgeon. Now, I was going down there to get fixed. I've often said that it occurred to me that this is certainly a new approach to alcoholism. Finally, Doc came in, and I was all prepared to tell him all about my symptoms, and he ushered me through a couple offices way in the back there and sat me down, and he started telling me all about me. And he scared the life out of me. I don't want to go into the long story why he did, but there was a real story connected with it, and I ran out on him. And I never stopped. Those 7 floors, I went down the stairway. The stairs are worse than the ones here. And I got out of that building, and I went back to resume my association with my jug buddies back in Cleveland. Now, the next thing that happened to me was the next real important thing in my life. Someone said here this morning about something that propels us in here. Here's how I was propelled into this fellowship. The gang of us were laying around there one day, all drunk, of course. Some of them passed out, some of them about to be, and some of them just coming out of it, and so forth and so on, but all of us in various states of drunkenness. And we got on this subject of quitting drinking. I think I must have brought this up myself this time, and I made this bland announcement that I was going to quit drinking. And I shall never forget this fellow who was sitting there, a loud mouth, a big mouth. He's drunk too, of course, and he looks at me. He said, you quit drinking? He said, you'll never quit drinking. He said, you don't have guts enough to quit drinking. You're no damn good. I still remember this thing. I looked at this flannel mouth bird, and I says, I am going to quit drinking. He said, you can't. He says, to quit drinking, he says, takes determination. He says, and to have determination, you need a chin. He said, look at you. You got a chin like Andy Gump. You're no damn good. I says, I'll show you. I know a doctor down in Akron can fix me. He says, nobody can fix you. I says, I'll show you. He said, you show me. So I got a hold of someone's phone. I'm sure they didn't have telephones in the surroundings we had. But I broke in somewhere, I don't know where, and Doc told me that I made a numerous calls to him about coming down, and he told me to meet him at Akron City Hospital in the morning. I only remember calling him, talking to him once. So I was there in the morning. I went down to Akron, and I shall never forget this. This was another great day in my life. I got to the bus station. I didn't have car fare to get out to Akron, and Akron is known as a city of seven hills, like Rome. And I'll kid you not, every hill is up. There's no downhills in Akron. I walked those hills, and it was a zero blizzardy day out to City Hospital. I only remember going into this hospital, and I conked out in the lobby. I fainted dead away when I went into the lobby. Next thing I know, there's a lot of commotion around. A lot of people in white outfits. And I seemed to be the center of attraction, which wasn't bad for change. They were giving me a bath. I don't know why, but I guess they have to do this in hospitals. But I remember this, the first thing I saw when I opened my eyes in that hospital, I looked over on that windowsill, and I see a big bottle of rub. They weren't so smart in hospitals yet then. They hadn't got smart enough yet about rummies and rubs. And I looked at that rub over there, and this gave me assurance. We hear this hymn, we sing this thing, hymn, Blessed Assurance. This was mine over on that windowsill. I came down there to quit drinking, but I was scared to death of ever going into the Rams. Some of my buddies had had those experiences, and I had not engaged in that kind of activity because I was not a periodic drinker. I was a chronic, and I never gave the Rams a chance to get going in my domain. So I was scared of this, and I figured if I hear the bells ringing and anything happening, or music and voices, I had my answer with that bottle of rub. And I knew that there was probably a bottle in every room on that floor. And I would have had no compunctions about getting myself a handful of those bottles right quick if anything happened to me. So I had my security there. And that gave me the courage to refuse the medicine that the nurse brought me, which was a big slug of liquor and a big slug of formaldehyde. I didn't take it. To this day, I've never had a drink. And that was in February 11th of 1938. Now, this was some visit to a hospital. I was expecting this doctor to fix me and do something. He was going to give me a treatment or operate or do something. I am sure of that, because I wouldn't be in a doctor in a hospital for any other reason. So every day, men came in to visit me. And they told me the stories of their lives. They were all rummies. They told me what had happened to them. And every man told me the same thing before he left. He said that he had the answer to my drinking problem. But he wouldn't give me the answer. He'd leave with that. I was in there a week. The last day I was in this hospital, I can remember this part of it. I was not eating yet. I know this because Paul Stanley came in at breakfast time to visit me, and he ate my breakfast for me. Paul was still there talking to me at noon, and he got my lunch. I got the dessert. I got a peach out of this. I can remember. It's funny things you can remember. Late in the afternoon, Doc came in, as he did every day, and he sat on the foot of my bed, a very unprofessional posture, of course, but he wasn't interested in professional postures. He sat there and looked at me for a couple minutes. Here was another very important day of my life. Finally, he says to me, young fella, he says, what do you think of all this by now? I says, Doc, I think this is great, all these fellas coming in here to visit me. They tell me they don't know me from a bale of hay, and they're spending their time down here. But I says, I'm puzzled about one thing. He says, what's that? They all tell me the story of their life, and they were real rummies, I know this, but they tell me one thing, that they have the answer to my problem, but they don't tell me what the answer is. What is this answer? What are you going to do to me now? What do I have to do? What's next? I shall never forget this next thing that Doc did to me. He looked at me, and Doc was a kind of a fella. Some of you folks have had the pleasure of meeting Doc. He was a tall, thin, angular, ascetic-looking fella, and he had fingers on him about this long. And he looked at me, and I had the feeling he could see right through me, and I think he could. And he says to me, he says, well, he says, I don't know, we don't know about you. He says, we don't know if you're ready for this yet. My God, what do you have to do to be ready? I weighed 130 pounds. I was completely unemployable. And if you don't believe it, you listen to this. This was in WPA days, and they wouldn't even take me on WPA. All my jug buddies got a whack at this, but I never even got a job holding a little flag. They wouldn't take me. And brother, if they won't take you on WPA, you're in a fine shape, socially and economically. And if that isn't enough evidence, my wife at that time, you know what her job was? You know, she's really interested in my going to work. She was head of the mail department of an employment agency, if you please. And she couldn't get me a job. So I would say that I wasn't much to offer to an employer. Well, anyway, this is the condition I'm in. I don't know where I'm going when I leave that hospital. I don't know anything. I'm completely gone. I don't have a dime. I have no clothes. I have no nothing. So he doesn't know if I'm ready yet. So I guess I had to convince him that I was ready. So I guess I finally did. He says, okay, well, I'm going to give you the answer to this. This made me feel pretty good. He's going to give me the answer now. So he turns around and looks at me, looks a hole through me, and he points his great big long finger at me. And he says, young fella, he says, do you believe in God? Well, this is the last thing I expected to hear from a medical doctor. And this really frightened me, and it really disappointed me. The first thing that went through this blubber up here is that here I am in this hospital for a week, and I'm under obligation to a bunch of religious nuts. The last thing I ever want to get tangled up with. So I had to avoid this question. So being a real smart guy, I tried it, you know. So I turn around, give him an obvious answer. I says, well, what does that have to do with it? He points that big long finger at me again. He says, young fella, that has everything to do with it. Do you or don't you? Now this is the way they hand the spiritual foundation of AA to a guy. It's a nice, easy way to slip it to you. So I had to do something about this. So the next thing I tell him, I says, well, he really wants an answer, you know. I says, well, I guess I do. That big finger comes up again. There's no guessing about it. You do or you don't. Do you believe or do you not? Just as plain as that. So what can I do? I'm stuck. So I finally says, yes, I believe in God. He says, that's fine. He says, that's good. Now we can get someplace. No sooner you let that out of him, he says, get out of that bed. I says, for what? He says, get down here, you're going to pray. I says, who's going to pray? He says, you're going to pray. I says, I don't know anything about praying. He says, I don't suppose you do. He says, get down here. He got me out of that, down to that concrete floor on my bones. And he says, I will say a prayer, and you can repeat this after me, and this will do for this time. So down I go there on that cold floor. I'd been in his bed for a week. And he uttered a prayer. I wish I knew what it was. I couldn't tell you. And I repeated it after him. I felt like a fool. It didn't kill me. However, I'm still here. But the next thing that happened after it was completed, he shook hands with me. And he says, young fella, you're going to be all right. And that night he carried me to a meeting. And that meeting was different than what we have today. It was a meeting of the old Oxford group. And I didn't know, and I never heard of the Oxford group, and I didn't know for weeks after I was going there what I was going to. You know, Oxford didn't mean anything to me. I knew there was a lot of people there. I knew the rummies who were there because they'd been in there to visit me, but the ones that startled me were the women. There were a lot of women there. I've gotten over this, being startled by women, but at that time it was rather bad. But there were more non-alcoholics than alcoholics. The alcoholics were in the minority. I was impressed with the idea that there are certain things I had to do the rest of my life if I was to stay sober. They told me that I was to dedicate my life to helping other alcoholics. I wanted so badly, I envied the men in that group who had sponsored someone and put someone in that hospital. I never felt I would really belong to this fellowship till I'd sponsored someone. This was something I had to prove to myself. And accordingly, of course, I went back to Cleveland. I went to these meetings at the Oxford group for 15 months, and I missed two in 15 months. I couldn't get through on account of the weather. But I tried. I became the first and foremost bar stool snatcher in AA history. I went every place where there were rummies. I would lie down with them, I'd sit down with them, I'd argue with them, I'd push them off stools. I'd do anything to talk to them. And naturally, I went to my jug buddies first. And I told them all they should be like me. They should quit drinking. And they looked at me and they don't want to be like me. This guy's nuts. So I didn't have any luck with anyone I knew. A prophet is always without honor in his own home, they tell me, and I found out the truth of that so many times since. So I went out among the strangers in the highways and the byways, and I worked for 7 long, heartbreaking months before I got my first baby in that hospital. Took me 7 long months. And they were discouraging and heartbreaking and heartrending sometimes. It was really, I don't know how I ever stuck with it, really. But it did. Just nuts, I guess. I'm a thick-headed Dutchman, and I get something in my head, it's awful hard to knock it out. I'm glad that my sponsor put things in there that amounted to something, and no one yet has been able to kick them out. I'm a hard head. And it's a good thing, because this has stood me in good stead over the years. Finally, I got my first guy. After that, I really was walking this high off the ground. After that, they come quite rapidly. And it wasn't long till we were having about 12 fellas going to Akron every week. Then the trouble began. We just started getting unity. And they go down and see this meeting that they're attending. And the odd part of it, here's how your AA started. You don't read this in AA books. I haven't seen any history that's written such as this, but this is how it was and how it is. You tell it how it was and how it is. Because I have no bones to pick with anybody on it. This is the way it happened. The Oxford movement was a movement of people who were trying to live better lives, who surrender their lives and their will to the care of God. They tried to live according to the 4 absolutes of honesty, unselfishness, purity, and love. It involved this surrender and a dedication. It involved getting guidance for one another, too. It involved open confession. It involved a lot of things. As it happened, about 8 out of the first 12 fellas that went down to Akron with me were Roman Catholics. And they get down there and they see this rigmarole, somebody reading out of the King James Version of the Bible, people having open confession on the floor, people getting guidance for other people, telling them what they should do. They had a direct wire to God, and they tell these people what they should do with their time, talents, and their substance. And these boys couldn't take this. The church wouldn't allow it. So every night I'm getting static all the way back to Cleveland from these guys. Had to do something about it. The book had come out by that time, and we had our 12 steps. So I went down to see my sponsor and told him what problem we had in Cleveland. They didn't have this problem in Akron. They only had one Catholic fellow in Akron, old Phil Smith, and he never did make it. He was a fallen away Catholic. He was all screwed up to start with. The time he got through this unity bit and Christian Science and all the rest of the things we were going into in the Oxford movement, this guy was really screwed up. It was impossible. The poor guy died drunk, really, and it was too bad. But they didn't have any problem with the other, with those type of people. There was other religious affiliations or people who go on to other theologies that couldn't take the same thing. But the Roman Catholics are the main one. So I figured we needed something, and we had something there, that we didn't need all these other things that were objectionable. So I went down and talked to my sponsor about it. He says, no, we can't do anything about it. That's the way it is. I says, but Doc, here's all we need is the 12 steps and the four absolutes. And this will change anybody's life. The Oxford movement's a life-changing program. Our 12 steps is a life-changing program. No, we owe too much to the Oxford group. We owe our lives to them. We couldn't do this. They're our friends. I says, I know, I owe my life to them, but I owe some to these fellows too. So do you. So do we all. There has to be a universality to this. Now, this is a lot of nerve for some guy that's about a year sober, a little over a year sober, to do. But I suppose at that stage of our game, we just don't have sense enough to know any better. And I was in that position. So Doc and I had an awful go-round about that. And I says, well, we're going to do something about it. He says, you can't do anything about it, he says. It's the way it is. I says, oh, yes, we can. He says, what are you going to do? I says, you just watch us. The next week I came down, we had a meeting place. We had another Irishman in the hospital, had a big house. He was losing it, but he still had it. I asked his wife if we could use his house for a meeting place. So next week I went down to Akron and made the announcement at the Oxford group. Now, you can imagine what happened here. I went in there and told him, this is the last time the Cleveland contingent is coming down to Akron as a group. So we're starting our own group in Cleveland, Ohio next Thursday night, and it's not going to be an Oxford group. It's going to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous. He took the name from the book. And boy, you should have heard the riot. Then I added this little goodie. I told them, no one but alcoholics and their families are welcome. Well, you can imagine, the roof went right off the house. Clarence, you can't do this. It's done. Let's come down tomorrow. We must talk about this. There's nothing to talk about. Next week, they all came up and crashed our meeting, and we had a real riot. One guy was going to whip me. You could hear him holler clear down to Memphis, Tennessee. And it was real bad. But we stood our ground, and that's the way AA started. It started in a riot. It grows in riots. And this is the way we progress. When anybody comes around and tells you that AA starts groups just because we need another group, you start examining his head. He's sicker than the rest of us. So groups start, and this is what they call AA unity, I guess. I hear or see all these signs about unity. Sometimes I wonder when this all started. The only unity I ever knew about in AA was riots, and this is the way we have grown. And it's the way we'll always grow. Because we're made this way. We aren't like other people. Other people who are not nuts like we are, form things and they get up charters and they get secretaries and presidents and vice presidents and committees and all this stuff. And they form some new Sertoma Club or new Lions Club or something like that. But AAs, what do we do when we start a group? We choose up sides with ball bats. That's the way we do. This is the way it's been. That's the way we had our first... You know how we got our first split in Cleveland? I'm the guy that took all this beating for all these monkeys, you can imagine. So finally we got these plain dealer articles, the thing that put AA on the map, really. These are the things that put AA on the map. And I got him. I sponsored some guy that was in a booby hatch, a newspaper man. Got him out of there and he wrote these articles. They're the greatest thing that ever happened in AA. This was long before the Alexander articles. Some of these fellows in the group took issue with this, and they accused me of getting money for these articles. They thought I was going to run their pictures in the paper and everything else. They got together and voted me out of AA. This is unity. So we got so unionized that right then and there, since I was getting voted out, a bunch of other guys went out with me, and we didn't have one group, but we had three. We didn't split in two groups, we split in three. This is the way we have unity. And this has been going on ever since. There are thousands and thousands of groups, and there are thousands and thousands and thousands of rummies attending them today. And I kid you not, that's the way it all goes. I owe a lot to these people in the Oxford group. They were great to me. Some people in particular, I shall never forget one of those men. He was an alcoholic, Bill Van Horn. I think Bill did something for me that had probably the greatest influence in changing my life at that time. Bill was a great big rough tough character. Doc had gotten him out of a booby hatch out in Maslin. He'd been confined to the Maslin State Funny Farm. Bill had a pension from First World War. Every time he'd get paid, he'd go out and he would try to whip the police force in Akron and in Kent, both places. He wasn't satisfied with one. And this got so bad that the folks finally had him probated and put away in the Funny Farm and threw the key away on him. Doc got him out and put him in the group, and he never had a drink to the day he died. And this great big gorilla took an awful liking to me. Why, I don't know. You can't know explaining these things. But he used to get me in a corner every night after a meeting and talk to me. So I shall never forget this night. This is another high spot in my life. Bill got me in a corner over there in T. Henry's home at the Oxford group meeting, after the meeting, and he took me over. He says, Clarence, he says, I'm going to give you the answer to this whole ball of wax. He says, I'm going to give you something here. I want you to read it. I want you to memorize it. I don't want you to ever forget it. You know, these are suggestions. This big gorilla looking at me, I'm looking up at him. I'm scared of the guy, really. He said, I'm going to give you this. Do what I tell you. So Bill takes out this old billfold of his, and he starts opening it up and putting all this debris and junk on the table here. All kinds of papers and pictures and clippings and everything but money. Finally, Bill comes to what he's looking for. He pulls out a slip of paper and he hands it to me. And I look at this slip of paper, and there's a Bible verse on this thing. And I look at this Bible verse, and I look at this big gorilla, and I thought, maybe Doc took him out too soon. But I didn't tell him that. So I did what Bill told me to do. I read that. I memorized it. I never have forgotten it. And I think it has done more. At that time, it was something that did more to change my life than anything else. Because it got through to me. It was a verse of 2 Corinthians, the 5th chapter and 17th verse. And it reads, therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. Think about that. Therefore, if any man be in Christ, if you turn your will and your life over, if any man be in Christ, all things are become new. Old things are passed away. What about our lives? Is your life anything like it was before you ever arrived here? What kind of a change is taking place? This is a life-changing program. The Oxford movement used to talk about a life-changing program. That's what they had. That's what they were devoted and dedicated to doing, changing lives. When this book was written and when these steps were written, I was in on this rat race. And if you think that somebody just got a flash out of the sky and wrote this program, don't you ever believe that fairy tale. That is not true. When this book was written and these steps were written, there were more riots taking place than have been since. This was something. You get a bunch of nuts up in New York and a bunch of them down in Akron, Ohio, by long distance writing back and forth, trying to get a program set up, and this one don't like this word, and somebody don't like that, and somebody else has got some other screwy notion. This is going back and forth in the mail. See, if you think this is something easy to do, this is the craziest damn setup you ever got into. How this book ever got out is a mystery. It's just another one of those marvels of the age, that's all. It never could have been done with a bunch of nuts like us. But it was, and we got it. But there it is. Now, I know something. I probably have a little different slant on these steps. Mac read these steps tonight. And you probably heard a lot of interpretations of the steps. I have too. And I have my own interpretation of them. And maybe I can be helpful to somebody in my interpretation of them. Because I probably have a little different slant on some than some of you have, having been there when they were written. And I'd like to go over them with you briefly tonight. Because it might enlighten someone and get you started. If any person here can get anything out of this, this is what I'm here for. Now, this program of ours is a life-changing program, and it's divided into four phases. First of all, if we're going to have to change our life, there has to be something wrong with it in the first place. So we must admit that there's something wrong. So our first step is a phase of admission. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. That's the phase of admission. All right, we admit this. So what? Anybody can admit they're a rummy, or they can admit they're a Chinaman. I don't care what it is, but we have to admit. We've made the admission, but where do we go from here? A lot of people like to make the admission and jump down to the last part of the 12th step, and they think they're in AA. Don't kid yourself. Long ways. You're further away from it than ever. The second phase of the program is a phase of submission. This is where we submit our will and our life to the care of God, and here's how we do it. Remember, I have to keep my program simple. I'm a pretty simple goof. I'm not too smart, I'm not too bright, and I have to have something simple. And I recognize the fact that most of us, when we get here, we don't have enough sense to come in out of a shower or rain. And if anybody starts giving them a complicated program, they're dead. They'll never make it. I meet some people come in here and think they're geniuses, you know. But they stick around for a little while and they prove it, you know. Don't take them long. But I am not talking about geniuses, I'm talking about rummies and alcoholics. And believe me, everybody can't be an alcoholic. You're to be congratulated if you're one. You know, a lot of people can never make this. I don't care how hard they try or how much they drink, they can't become an alcoholic. I know this because I used to drink with a lot of jugheads that could drink as much booze as I could, and I'd grant you that's a big order, but they were not alcoholics. Those guys could quit drinking anytime they wanted to if they got some other little hobby come their way or something else come in their little mind. But not the alcoholic. He doesn't quit this way. The only way I know for an alcoholic to quit is by a complete change in his life, complete change in himself. If any man be in Christ, he's a new creature. It's the only way I know of a guy to really quit and have a peace in his life. The second phase says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We came to believe it. It doesn't say we believed when we got here. How did I come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity? And don't let that sanity bit scare you. We're all nuts. If you're not nuts, you don't belong here. You better go join something else. This is a society of the nuts. You think it isn't? There's no alcoholic in this room worthy of the name who can think logically, or does he react logically? If you don't believe this, look back over your career and see some of the little petty things you did, like getting yourself all straightened up on a new job and a new wife and a new house and a new car, and all of a sudden everything's going so good, boom, the whole thing goes. This is logical. This is sensible. This is the actions of a sane man. The things we did are actions of a sane man, aren't they? I should say not. I was glad when they put that sanity deal in there. I'm glad that I was nuts. I'd hate to think that some of the things I did when I was drinking, I would be pointed out as a sane man pulling that kind of stuff. This being nuts took me off the hook. So, it says, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I came to believe this because of the power of example of these other men. They told me, I recognized them as rummies, I wanted what they had. And they told me a power could help me. That's what they left with me when they left. They had the answer to my problem, they told me. Doc gave me the answer eventually. So I wanted to believe this. That's why I came to believe it. This next step is a step that's all important. Here's the one that separates the men from the boys. Upon the third step, just depends whether or not you're going to be in AA or not. It says on this third step, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. How about that? We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. When you ask a rummy, a person who has been as willful and as conniving as we have been, a guy that always wants to have an ace in the hole somewhere or he can crawl out of or something, ask him to turn his will and his life over to the care of this ethereal creature out here in the blue yonder, of whom he knows very little about and probably scared to death of. Do you expect him to do that? Believe me, he's not going to do that unless he really hurts. He's not going to do that on common sense. He's not going to do that by thinking his way through. I hope you don't have a signed think up here, because when I get up on a podium and they have that think sign, I usually turn it over. It scares me to death to even suggest to a bunch of rummies they should think. If you get thinking, you're going to get in trouble. A rummy don't think. This is the difference between us and earth people, civilians. They think. They think. We feel. This is why you and I get along together. We feel together. We feel about the same thing. And no rummy's going to make any decision on the way he thinks. He's going to make decisions on how he feels. Do you all go out and talk to some guy when he's roaring drunk? You talk to him when he's coming off of that drunk, when he really hurts, and he's scared, and he's got the shakes, and he's got this and that, and he feels his worst. That's when they hit a rummy. Don't hit a rummy when he's anesthetized. We only move when we feel a certain way. This is a big failure in most of the rehabilitation plans that we have today. They assume that the rummy is a logical thinking creature. And he's anything but. This is why psychiatry and AA don't mix. You're going to take one route or the other. You're either going the route of psychiatry or you're going the route of turning your will and your life over to the care of God to run it for you. If you can run your life yourself by the way a psychiatrist lays it out for you, I doubt like the devil that you're a 24-carat rummy. I think you're about 14. Really. Because you and I don't respond to that. We don't think, we don't have this logic. We have to get in a certain way of feeling in here, and then we'll do something. This third step, no rummy's going to do this third step unless he hurts real bad and means business and wants to help himself in the worst way. It says in our fifth chapter of our book, if you want what we have, remember this, and if you are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you are now ready to take certain steps. This is a third step. This is where it separates the men from the boys. If you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length, you mean you're not willing to turn your will and your life over to the care of God? Well, okay, Buster, you're not in AA. You might be in BB or you might be in ZZ, but you sure as hell are not in AA. Glad you appreciate that. That's the truth. You don't ever forget that. Here's why when a person comes to AA, nobody says, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Why did you get drunk? Why did you blow this? Why did you blow that? We've been having all those whys all of our life from people. Good, sensible people. Every one of us, there isn't a person sitting in this room who hasn't had the same advice I've had. I've had $1 million worth of good advice given me while I was drinking. It was good. Those people told me exactly what was going to happen to me if I didn't modify my drinking pattern. They told me I'd lose my home, I'd lose my family, I'd lose my job, I'd lose my health, I'd lose my sanity, I'd lose everything I had. They were so right, I did. This didn't change this situation. I never changed. Till I felt a certain way. Those men brought something to me. And it got me working in here. Not in here, because I had nothing in here to work with. And that's for sure. If I had time, I'd like to explain the reasons for this thing here, but I don't have the time for this tonight. They're only allowing me 2 hours tonight. All right. We're in AA. We took that third step. Turned our will and our life over to the care of God. From now on, we have no drinking problem anymore. We turned that over to Him. Remember this. Have it. Next step, what does it do? If we're going to have a new life, we're going to have to find out what we have to work with. So we take, listen to this fourth step. It says, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. How do you like that? A searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I don't think there's a rummy worthy of the name who's capable or has the capacity to take that step by himself. They talk about honesty. I hear a lot of this bourgeois from podiums about the honest desire for this and honest that and honest that. When you start talking about honesty to rummy, you're nuts. You're getting back in the dark ages. Don't ever tell him he's honest or he has to do something honest. This is a virtue we have to cultivate and learn about and do something about. It's hard for us to come in here with anything honest. I wasn't the worst guy in the world, but I'll tell you one thing, sure. I would steal a red-hot stove if I could convert it into something to drink. If I had to have it, I would do it. There's nothing that I wouldn't do. Honesty, this is something that scares a rummy. Let's go very soft on that for a while till the guy gets a little conditioned to us. I've been in this thing for over 30 years. I can still figure things too, you know. I haven't forgotten some of these things. Every once in a while I look at things with an appraising eye. Yeah. This is part of the nature of the beast. We don't become perfect in here. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. What have we got to work with? What kind of moral sense or responsibility do we have? What's going for us? What's going against us? Let's list these things. The fifth step suggests that someone was there helping us. I don't think anybody can do this by himself. I really don't. We don't have that kind of integrity to do this by ourselves. We've been so accustomed to justifying our actions all through our lives that fourth step, we could skip that very easily. The nature of the alcoholic will make us do it unless we have somebody at our elbow there suggesting things and pointing things out and making it easy for us to admit these things. The fifth step suggests there was someone at our elbow because it says we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. It doesn't say all the things that we committed. It says the exact nature of our wrongs. It doesn't say anything about admitting all the indiscretions we had committed over our lifetime. My heavens to Betsy, we can't even remember them in the first place, but we have to figure out what type of things these are and admit to them, to God, because we're turning our will and our life over to that fella, you know, to ourselves and to another human being we're doing this. We're putting ourselves on record. This is important. This is why we should have a sponsor who is a knowledgeable person in these things. He don't necessarily have to be an AA, but he has to be some person who is knowledgeable in these things of human actions. The next step says we were entirely ready, it says, remember that, to have God remove all these defects of character. Someone said this morning, there are some defects that he just didn't want to let go of yet. I think we heard this last night. Well, I am very free to admit there's a few of these little ditties and goodies I'd like to keep too. And I don't think you're much different than I am, unless you're nuttier than I am. But the program don't call for that. The alcoholic is an extremist. That's one of our characteristics, and we have to do everything entirely. So it says we're entirely ready to have God remove them. We can't do it. Let's not try to get in that driver's seat again. Let God do it. We're entirely ready to have Him remove all the defects of character. No reservations. This is important. So then we humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. We didn't make a deal. We didn't say, God, if you'll do this, we'll do that. We just humbly asked him. That's the submission steps. We have now admitted our failings, admitted we had a need for a change, and we have submitted our will and our life to the care of God, and we've actually done something about it. Now, if we're going into a new life, we have to clean up the old. So now comes the next phase. The third phase is a phase of restitution. Here's where we made a list of all persons we had harmed. All persons we had harmed. Now listen to this. And became willing to make amends to them all. Get that? There's some people who we had some feelings about. We probably didn't want to do this. I'm very frank to admit there was a couple people in my experience when I thought of making amends to them, it got occurred to me that I would like to own a hotel with 1,000 rooms and find them dead in every room. Now, it's hard to make apologies to people like that and restitution. But the program insists we do. It says we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Obviously, we can't make amends to everyone. We don't know everyone we've harmed. We have to leave that to God. But the ones we know, we have to do something about. Because the next step says we may direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. This is a step that has to be taken. I should say ought to be taken with your sponsor. Because we can get a lot of enthusiasm. We still don't have anything here yet to guide us. And we need someone to look after us. And our sponsor should help us in this restitution, because we can sure louse up a lot of deals on this restitution thing with a lot of enthusiasm and no sense. I never assume that a guy has a bloody brain in his head when I go out to see him. If I do, I get myself disappointed. This is the only way to start with a fella. You have to start doing his thinking for him until he can think for himself. We don't have to exactly think for him. We can get feelings for him. Things we do for him seem to work out just about right if we qualify him to begin with. So there is the restitution. We've gone through three phases: admission, submission, and restitution. Now listen to this one here, because people have heard me say this, and this really starts a riot in some sectors. It's the first time I ever said this. People haven't gotten over it yet because they don't listen. The good Lord gave us two ears and one mouth. You know, this suggests something to me. This, after we have taken and done these nine steps, after we've taken them and done them. And when do we do that? Well, when do you want to get well? You do it now, when you come in. Somebody tells me, I'm working on your third step. I'm working on the fifth step. I'm working on the... What are you working on? What are you doing? What do you mean you're working on it? You don't work on it. You take them and you drop them. You make a decision once. You don't have to keep making it all over again. If you want to get well, here's a prescription. You get sick, you go to the doctor, he gives you a prescription. It's got a lot of sweet stuff and sour stuff and stinking stuff in it. If you don't like sour stuff, you'd have him take it out if you don't get well. You take the prescription the way the doctor orders it to you, and you'll have a good chance of getting well. If you start writing your own prescriptions, you'll get thrown in the can for practicing medicine without a license. But here you are. Here's a prescription for getting well, getting your life changed. You're going to change it already, are you? You better not. There's nine steps. We have taken them. We have made our admission. We submitted our will and our life to care of God. We've taken our end and we've made our restitution. All right. After this, forget those nine steps. Forget them. You don't have to mess with them anymore. There's only two times in your life that you might have to refer to those first nine steps. And the first time is if you ever resign and resume and become a periodic AA, you're going to have to go through those steps again, because obviously you resign and you have to start all over again. Or you've missed the boat, or you haven't taken some of the steps, and that's why you're drunk again. All right? So you forget those 9 steps. You don't have to worry about them. Isn't that a load off your mind and off your back? You don't have to worry about 9 steps anymore. We have 3 steps. These are our living steps, and these are the steps of construction. Listen to these steps. These are the only 3 you have to be concerned about. The other nine, the only time you use them, as I say, if you ever resign from us and you have to start new again, if you ever get that chance. Or when you're trying to explain them to someone, such as I'm doing now, then you have to know what they're about. So forget them. As far as your usage, God help you and God love you, you should never have to use them again for yourself, you see? Now, this is a very simple program. You only have to use 3 steps now. The steps of construction. Listen to this. The 10th step says we continue to take personal inventory. It says personal inventory. It doesn't say a moral inventory. Now, that 10th step has not one thing to do with the 4th step at all. The 4th step, you're talking about a moral inventory. 10th step, you're talking about something entirely different. We continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. Now, that's a real switch for Rummy to ever admit he's wrong. Hell, he won't admit it's raining outside. It might involve him in something. This is the way we are. So we continue to take personal inventory. What does that mean? I'll tell you how I do mine. As I say, I'm a very simple guy. I don't have too much sense, and I have to keep my program simple. And so far, it's been pretty well with me, believe me. When I look at myself today, and I hear some of these people speak today, and they tell about the blessings they've received. I have all these blessings, too. I have a lot of friends. I think about some days the friends I have. I think about that day on the waterfront where I didn't have one friend up in the world. I think of the thousands of people today. I could come and visit you, and I'd be welcome in your home. I could stay with you overnight. I could eat in your home. Many, many people all over the country. I could do this. I could live the rest of my life just out visiting people if I wanted to. It's a great social security. Yeah, I could be the greatest high-class bum in the world. I don't doubt you'd even give me clothes. Now, this 10th step says we continue to take personal inventory. And when we're wrong, we promptly admitted it. What inventory? I'm telling you how I take mine. At night, I'm in bed. I'm alone. It's dark. My day is over with. I'm a salesman. I deal with people all day long. And any of you folks who are salesmen or saleswomen probably will be in agreement with me that there ought to be an open season on customers. We should be able to shoot people with impunity. We do have troubles with some of them. Oh, I don't care. You deal with people, you're always having problems. Okay. I lay there at night. It's my prayer time. And I think about my day. I think whom I've met and what I've done and what I've accomplished or what I've missed or what I've failed in today. I do this every night. Sometimes I'm not very proud of what I've done today. Really? On the other hand, sometimes I feel I have done something that's worthwhile. If I have, I pat myself on the back. I say, oh boy, you did good in that time. You're all right. You get a little star that time for that. I don't just lay there and damn myself for everything that I have bungled up today. And we're all going to bungle things. This is life. Anybody's doing anything is going to bungle things sometimes. I think about these things, and if I have offended anyone, if I owe any apologies, I get right to it. If I have some unfinished business, I take care of it. Really. I can't afford to carry things over. I can't do it. I don't have the capacity to handle things when they start building up on me. I have found in my 30-some years in AA, in working with people and loving people and sympathizing with people, that it isn't the big things that throw the rummy. We don't get drunk because of some big disaster. Not at all. It's the little things. Therefore, we must take care of the little things. After all, there's not too many big things ever happen to us anyway. But those big things we're able to handle when they do come along. But the little ones, they grow and grow, and they get so much that we can't handle them anymore. And they consume us. And they change our sets of values. They change our directions. And they get us back into the old patterns. This is what these little things do if we don't handle them every day. This is the importance of that 10th step. It's a tremendous step. It has nothing to do with the 4th step. Don't get them confused. It's an entirely different approach to our lives. This is a step we take continuously. We take the 4th step once. We take this thing all the time, every day. A tremendous step. Listen to the 11th step. These are our living steps. This is what we live with. This is how we live. The 11th step says, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. Listen, that's a lot of words, isn't it? We're seeking something, it says. So we sought through prayer and meditation. We're seeking this thing, whatever it is, through prayer and meditation. Well, just what is prayer and what is meditation? This is something probably confuses people. Prayer is talking to God. Meditation is listening to Him. Remember those two ears and that one mouth? A lot of people don't do any listening. They do all the talking, although they're supposed to listen twice as much. If you don't listen for answers, how are you going to get them? So we're seeking through talking to Him and listening to Him. What are we seeking? We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. What in the world is that? Conscious contact with God. Many of us think that God, we have an idea of some guy with a long white beard and long flowing robes way up here in the blue yonder. That isn't where He is at all. We're seeking this conscious contact with Him, and in my seeking that, I have found that He's awfully close. And I have authority for that. The good book tells us that He's closer than hands and feet. That's pretty close, you know. He's in here. He's not way out here. He's in here. God is in us. It says something in the good book about our body is a temple of God. He lives in there. We are supposed to keep this clean. It says this in the good book. This is where He is, not way out here. So I'm talking to Him and listening to Him, trying to establish a conscious contact with Him so I can feel Him and talk to Him and know that He's right here. This is what it amounts to. Now it tells us what we're praying for. People talk about praying for sobriety all the time. You don't have to pray for sobriety. Heaven's the best that you have sobriety. Thank Him for it. Don't ask Him for it. He's given it to you. He's taken all this. You turned your will and your life over to Him a long time ago. You think He's going to keep you drunk? It's absolutely ridiculous. You don't pray for sobriety. You pray for health, strength, guidance, direction, and the strength and the wisdom to serve. That's what we pray for. Not sobriety. Forget sobriety. Do you see anything in this whole 12-step program that says you shouldn't drink? Does it say one word about not drinking in this program? If it does, show me where it is. It doesn't say one thing about that. It doesn't say you should either. But believe me, if we accept this program and apply it, there isn't going to be any drinking because this isn't the way we live anymore. We have a different sense of values. We have something else which has come into us. And we have something that we express ourselves with. So we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, and we're praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. God, what do You want me to do? That's what it says. And give me the strength to do it. And the good book further promises us that He'll never put anything on us that He won't give us the strength to execute. Right? That's our 11th step. It's a tremendous step. How many people ever thought of it in these lights? The 12th step, listen to this one. Here's the most abused one in the whole caboodle. It says here, having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps. See, we took these steps and as a result we had a spiritual experience. And just what in the world is that? That's a change. That's in here. That's a different feeling. It isn't the way we think. It's the way we feel. It's the way we're going to be living. It's us. It's way down in here. having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, having gone through these steps, this change has come to us. Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he's a new creature. Old things are passed away, behold, all things have become new. This is what's happened. We tried to carry this message. We tried to carry this message, not the alcoholic, the message. We tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. Did you get that? To other alcoholics. We are not going to try to reform the world, nor are we going to educate the world. Forget this education BS. To me, it's so much hogwash. You and I have enough to do to work with rummies. And you and I are specialists in this direction, in this field, because we're all rummies, and we're the only ones that can feel like a rummy. And we're the guys that can save their lives and help them change their lives. We can't do one thing for the civilians, and we can't make these people understand what we're trying to do, because they think. And when they get thinking and we're feeling, there's no connection. Remember this. They are thinking and they're smart. We're nuts. Don't forget that. We feel. So there's no communication and no connection. Having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics. We don't want to fill our room up here with a bunch of civilians and come in for a good time or entertainment. This is serious business with us. We have a lot of fun. We have more fun than anybody in the world. Who has more fun than a bunch of rummies? Nobody has more fun than we do. Believe me, I've been with rummies all over this country and out of the country. They all feel the same way. They all are just as silly and simple as I am. We all laugh about crazy stuff. Everybody's talking, nobody's listening, and this goes on every place. You don't want to get mixed up with these smart civilians and spoil this for us. We were born with a bunch of civilians, and we had to get away from them. This is where the Oxford group, that's what the break from the Oxford group, get away from those people. We would have all died of boredom if we'd stayed with those monkeys. I don't say this in a disrespectful way. I think they have their place in the world, but we have our own niche. Everybody can't be an alcoholic. Remember this. This is a privilege reserved for a chosen few. And you and I have this, and we have something else. We have, of all people, you and I are the most blessed. Often here it's said that the Jews are the chosen people. Don't you believe it, unless it's a Jew in AA. We are the chosen people. There isn't one of us sitting here that deserves what we have, but by the grace of God we were given it. And what do we do with it? When we're given such a thing as this, we're expected to do something with it. And as an example, I refer you to the story of the talents, the parable of the talents. We're not all five-talent guys. We're not all two-talent guys. We may all be one-talent guys, but we're supposed to use it. And we have this. And in sharing this with one another, this is where we get this great joy. There's no society in the world like ours. I've been around long enough to have been able to get into other societies because AA offered me the opportunity to join other societies. I've been in the line in lodges, I've been chaplain in a lodge, and I've been in legion work, and I've been in all kinds of outside activities. I was president of our ball club. I've played ball for many years, and I still do. I belong to that club. They're the silliest bunch of people in the world. They're civilians. They don't know anything. They have worse problems than we have. Little things are big deals with them, all these people. I don't mean to run them down, but I say that we are in a society where we are chosen, and there's no society like this. Let's treasure this, and let's enjoy it, and let's help one another. Let's not take ourselves too seriously. But let's take this program awful seriously. This is life and death. This is a tremendous thing. And out of all the millions and millions of people, alcoholics, who have stumbled across the face of this world in times gone by and today, you and I and a few thousand other people have had this opportunity. We are really blessed. This alcoholism is the oldest thing in the world. You hear about it from way, way back. The antics of alcoholics and things that have happened. Alcoholism is old as time itself. You read about it in ancient history, you read about it in mythology, you read about it in the Bible. The very first book of the Bible tells you about a rummy. If you don't believe it, read about Noah. There is a rummy. Oh, but a rummy would do a stunt that he pulled. And didn't he get really snockered on that ark? You read that story, and you see records of alcoholism and drinking and all this kind of jazz from way back. This is nothing new, but our fellowship. God, it's come to a place where God had to do something. I think that we're a challenge to Him. And He did something for us. He chose some of us. And here we are. Let's do what should be done with it. Let's appreciate it. Let's be very thankful for it. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. I have to sign off. Some people want me to tell about Catherine tonight, but I don't have the time. I get on to some of these stories, I really ought to be here till tomorrow morning. It isn't hard to figure that out. But meantime, let me say this. May your faith be equal to your dreams, and may your courage match your opportunities. Thank you.